jars. Hundreds of shimmering candles lined long picnic tables. Above my head hung a magnificent chandelier that lit up the moose head and black bear hide on the wall. I took a seat across from a woman who seemed to jump between three conversations at once. Her enthusiasm was so electric, I didn't realize I was staring. "Hey you," she said, "Mickey Agarwal." She gave me a fist pound and then pointed to the men seated beside us. "This is my boy Jesse, this is my boy Ben, and this is my boyfriend Andrew." I introduced myself to Mickey and she sped on. "Alex, want to hear something crazy? I met Jesse playing pickup soccer in Central Park 10 years ago. He was selling textbooks over the phone at the time, 25 cents a pop. I said he's smarter than that and yelled at him to get his shit together. We hung out for a bit, but I literally haven't seen Jesse since. Today I found out he's now an executive at Nike." Mickey gleamed as if she had done it herself. "Ben, you have to tell Alex your story." In the time it took Ben to put down his wine glass, Mickey was already saying it herself. "It's crazy. Ben and his boys were in college, felt like they were in a slump, so they made a list of 100 things they wanted to do before they died. They bought a van, traveled the country, and crossed things off the list. And every time they did, they also helped a stranger reach one of their dreams too. Ben, come on, tell Alex some of the things you did." Ben told stories about playing basketball with President Obama, streaking at a professional soccer game, helping deliver a baby, and going to Las Vegas and betting $250,000 on black. These adventures went on for years and became the MTV reality show, The Buried Life, which then led to a best-selling book. The more Ben went on about how fulfilling it was to chase his dreams, the more I thought about how Elliot was asking me to give up my own. "I was pretty much the opposite of Ben out of college," Mickey said. "I worked on Wall Street and hated it." "What changed?" I asked. "September 11th, she said. Mickey had a breakfast meeting scheduled at the World Trade Center courtyard at the time the North Tower was hit. "In my entire life," she said, "that was the only morning I slept through my alarm and missed a meeting." Among the thousands who were tragically killed that day were two of Mickey's coworkers. "It hit me that you never know when your life will be over," she said. "And I felt I would be an idiot to waste my days living out someone else's life rather than living my own. I felt like my body was the rope of a tug of war. Elliot's offer was yanking on one side, Mickey and Ben the other." Mickey said that after that realization, she quit her job and chased every interest she had. She worked her way onto a professional soccer team, wrote a movie script, and then opened an organic gluten-free pizzeria in New York's West Village. She was now starting a woman's underwear line called Things and writing a book called Do Cool Shit. "Alex, your turn," Mickey said. "Story, go, go, go." As I told them the Price is Right story, they laughed and cheered and threw me high fives. Mickey asked what I had to do next for the mission, and I said I was searching for a literary agent so I could land a book deal and get to Bill Gates. "So far," I said, "every agent I've reached out to has said no." "Dude, I'll introduce you to my agent," Ben said. "Talk to mine too," Mickey said. "She'll love you." "Are you kidding? That would be amazing." The ding of a fork against a glass cut through the air. Elliot was standing at the front of the room, making a toast. "Here at Summit," he said, "we have a little tradition. We like to take a moment during dinner to give thanks. For our chefs, for the food, and most of all, for each and every one of you. Welcome to Eden!" We clinked glasses and the room erupted in cheers. Elliot continued and said he wanted to thank one person in particular at dinner, Tim Ferriss. Elliot pointed his glass toward Ferriss, who I realized was sitting a few tables behind me, and said that Tim was the first person to teach him that he didn't have to sit behind a desk all day to succeed. He could work while traveling, adventuring, and expanding his mind. "Tim," Elliot said, "showed me how to reimagine my life." 100 pairs of eyes turned to Ferriss, bathing him in a collective spotlight. "To Tim," Elliot shouted. "To Tim," we roared back. And just as Tim mentored me and holds a special place in my heart, Elia continued. There is someone else here who's beginning to hold a similar spot. Just as I had cold emailed Tim when I was starting out, this someone cold emailed me. I began to feel the heat rising in my face. Elliot told a Price is Right story better than I ever could. Then he pointed his glass at me. That's the kind of creativity we embrace here at Summit. That's the kind of energy we empower here. That's why I've taken Alex Benayan under my wing, and that's why I'm proud to welcome him as the newest member of our community. To Alex! If on Friday I felt like a pinball, on Saturday I was a magnet. Are you the kid Elliot was talking about last night? Are you the one who hacked the Price is Right? How long have you known Elliot? Are you two related? What's the project you're working on? What can I do to help? Elliot not only brought me into a new world, he kicked down the doors. This is what I've always wanted, I thought. If I work with Elliot, I'll never have to leave. All these people are coming to me, gushing to help with the mission. But if I accept his offer, there will be no mission. On Sunday morning, I sat alone at the breakfast table, too conflicted to eat. Elliot's words from New York replayed in my mind. If you don't take this, you're making the biggest mistake of your life. The more I reflected on his offer, the more I felt the threat underneath. Something about his tone and the sharp look he had in his eyes told me, if you say no, we're over. No more Eden, no more mentor. In a few hours, I had to leave to catch my flight home, and I still didn't know what I would tell him. Rough morning, an attendee pulled up a chair beside me, cradling a cup of coffee. Sort of, I said. The man was tall and had a gentle face. For reasons that will become clear later, I'll use a pseudonym for him and call him Dan Babcock. I must have been desperate to get the thoughts off my chest, because I soon found myself confiding in Dan about my internal tug of war. What do you think I should do? I don't think anyone can tell you what to do, Dan said. It's a hard decision. The only person who knows the right answer is you. But maybe I can share something that might help. Dan reached for his notebook, ripped out two sheets of paper, and handed them to me. I worked for Warren Buffett for 7 years, he said. And out of everything he's taught me, this was his greatest piece of advice. I pulled a pen out of my pocket. On the first sheet of paper, Dan said, write a list of 25 things you want to accomplish in the next 12 months. I wrote things related to my family, health, working with Elliot, working on the mission, places I wanted to travel, and books I wanted to read. If you could only do 5 of those things in the next 3 months, Dan said, which would you choose? I circled them. Dan told me to copy those 5 things onto the second sheet of paper, and then cross them off the first. You now have 2 lists, he said. On the top of the list of 5, write the priority list. I scribbled it across the top. All right, he said. Now, over the list of 20, write the avoidance list. Huh? That's Mr. Buffett's secret, Dan said. The key to accomplishing your top 5 priorities is to avoid the other 20. I looked at my list of 5, then at my list of 20. I see your point, I said, but there are things on that avoidance list that I really want to do. You have a choice, Dan said. You can be good at those 25 things, or you can be world class at the 5. Most people have so many things they want to do that they never do a single thing well. If I've learned one thing from Mr. Buffett, it's that the avoidance list is the secret to being world class. Success is a result of prioritizing your desires. Each shirt I packed in my duffel bag reminded me of a day in Barcelona. Every pair of pants, a night in New York. I got in my rental car, headed back to Elliot's cabin, and found him by the front door, chatting with one of his guests. Elliot finished his conversation and came over. "Enjoy the weekend?" he asked. "It was incredible," I said. "I can't thank you enough, and I think I have my answer." A wide smile spread across his face. "I love Summit," I said, "and I've never had a mentor like you in my entire life. But at the same time, I don't think I can live with myself doing two things half-assed. I need to do one thing right, and it has to be the mission." Elliot's jaw clenched. He slowly lowered his head as if he was trying to suppress his anger. "You're making a huge mistake," he said. But then he stopped himself before saying anything else. He took in a heavy breath and let his shoulders deflate. "If that's what you have to do," he said, "then that's your decision, and I respect you even more for making it." He put his hand on my shoulder. "And just know," he added, "you always have a home here. I love you, man." Chapter 15. You can't out-Amazon Amazon. The following day, I returned to the storage closet feeling completely renewed. I fixed my gaze on the white sheet of paper on the wall. 5 words were scribbled across the top, and at this point in my life, no words were more important. No agent, no Bill Gates. Without a literary agent, I couldn't get a publishing deal. And without a deal, I couldn't get to Gates. From the day I had started this journey, I had felt that Bill Gates' advice would be my holy grail. So in my eyes, the mission wouldn't be complete without him. I sat at my desk, checked my email, and of course, there was another rejection. I uncapped my pen and drew a line through the agent's name on my list. There were now lines through 19 of the 20 names. I looked at the tower of books on my desk about the publishing process. I had followed every word those books prescribed. I did everything the best-selling authors I had spoken to advised me to do. Why isn't this working? The last rejection, though, was different from the rest. It didn't sting as much. As I drew a line through that agent's name, I felt as if I was drawing a line through the idea of this list altogether. I didn't need it anymore. Now, I had Mickey and Ben. I called Mickey to see if her offer still stood. "Are you kidding?" she said. "Of course! My agent will love you. Come to New York!" "When should I?" "Book your ticket right now! And don't even think about wasting money on a hotel. You're staying in the extra bedroom in my apartment." When I called Ben, he also said he'd set up a meeting for me with his agent. I bought a plane ticket to New York, and the next day, right before heading out, I ripped the list of agents off the storage closet wall so I could drop it in the trash. I don't know why, but something within me said otherwise, so I just folded the list and stuffed it in my pocket. After arriving at JFK Airport, I jumped into a cab and went straight to Mickey's gluten-free pizzeria in the West Village. As soon as I put my duffel bag in the back room, Mickey sat me down and got to the point. "Which agents have you talked to so far?" Now I knew why I hadn't thrown away the list. I pulled it out of my pocket. Mickey pointed to the name at the top. "Why is this the only one not crossed off?" "Well, that's the agent I wanted the most. She's repped 23 books that became New York Times bestsellers. She's headquartered in San Francisco, gets huge deals with major publishers, and I get it, but why isn't she crossed off?" I spoke to one of the authors she represents, and when I asked him for an introduction, he said to not even bother reaching out. This agent didn't represent him on his first book, she didn't represent Tim Ferriss on his first book, and if I can't even get a meeting with smaller agents, then who am I kidding? I'm optimistic, but I'm not delusional. We don't have time for failure, Mickey said. She grabbed my arm and pulled me toward the door. Let's go, let's go, let's go, she said. There's an hour before the dinner rush. Mickey yanked me through the Manhattan streets as she wove around pedestrians, running across intersections, leaping in front of honking cars. When we got to her agent's office building, Mickey swung open the front door, sped past the front desk, and down a hallway. An assistant with a comb-over jumped up and flailed an arm in the air. Mickey, wait! You don't have an appointment! Mickey practically kicked down her agent's door, pushed me in, and I saw her agent sitting at a cluttered desk, phone to her ear. Her face turned white. Papers were scattered around the room. Books were piled on the floor. Drop what you're doing, Mickey said. I need 10 minutes. The agent mumbled into the phone and put it down. Alex, take a seat, Mickey said, pointing to the couch. Tell her about your book. I made my pitch, spitting out every fact and statistic and marketing idea I could, exactly like the authors I'd spoken to advised me. I spoke with all the passion I had, and by the end of the meeting, Mickey told her agent that she had to work with me, and her agent nodded. This all sounds great, she said. Alex, send me your proposal. I'll read it and get back to you as soon as I can. I walked out of the office building, glowing. The New York City sidewalk was just as loud as ever, but for a moment, the noise seemed to fade away. Little bro, let's roll, Mickey hollered. She was already halfway down the block, speeding away. I ran to catch up. I can't thank you enough, I said, trailing behind her. Don't think of it, she said. When I was younger, a group of 30-year-old entrepreneurs took me under their wing and did the same for me. This is how the world works. It's the circle of life. A day later, the circle kept on giving. I was escorted across the shimmering tile floors of William Morris Endeavor, one of the most powerful talent agencies in the world. I felt like everybody I passed in the halls knew that Ben had set up this meeting for me. Ben's book had hit the New York Times bestseller list a few months prior, so there were no doors that needed kicking down. Ben's agent stood up from her desk and gave me a warm welcome. Her office was large and had sweeping views of the skyline. We sat on her couch, I made my pitch, and because my meeting with Mickey's agent had gone so well, I doubled down on my approach. I laid out even more statistics, spit out even more facts, and focused even more on marketing ideas. I spoke to Ben's agent for more than an hour, and at the end, she too asked me to send her my proposal. I felt the meeting couldn't have gone better. The next day, I flew back to LA, feeling triumphant. When I stepped back into the storage closet, I saw the gigantic tower of books on my desk and wanted to kiss it the way a hockey player kisses the Stanley Cup. Over the course of a week, I sent follow-up emails to both Ben's and Mickey's agents. There was no response from Mickey's, but a few days later, Ben's called. Alex, I loved meeting you, and I think you're great, but there's always a but I don't think we're a fit, though I know someone here who might be. She introduced me to one of her colleagues at William Morris. I got on the phone with her coworker, made my pitch, and for some reason, right on the spot, she said yes. I put the call on mute as I cheered out loud. I felt as if the brick wall that had blocked my path to Bill Gates was blasted by dynamite. And the dynamite wouldn't stop detonating. The very next day, another author I knew introduced me to another agent at William Morris who also said yes on the spot. I booked a plane ticket to fly back to New York to meet the two William Morris agents in person. I didn't understand why Mickey's agent hadn't replied yet, but that also seemed like a guaranteed yes. Either way, now it was my turn to decide. I walked off the subway in New York a few days later. As I felt the warm summer sun on my face, I reached into my pocket to check my phone. There was an email from one of the William Morris agents, sent on behalf of both of them. It effectively said, "Dear Alex, we regret to inform you that we have to rescind our offers." Apparently, both agents were brand new, and because they both extended me offers, they met with their boss about how to handle the situation. The verdict was for both of them to drop me altogether. Their boss decided I wasn't worth the time. It felt like the sidewalk was pulled from under me. Never in my life had I felt so worthless. In that instant, it hit me that if I wasn't good enough for the 19 agents on my list, if I wasn't good enough for the 2 agents who were just getting started, Mickey's agent was never planning on signing me either. She was only nice to me in the meeting to please Mickey, not because she wanted to work with me. I was nothing. I was nobody. I wasn't even worth a response. I went to Mickey's apartment completely gutted. I pulled out my list of agents and saw those 5 words at the top glaring back at me. No agent, no Bill Gates. I crumpled the paper in my fist and threw it at the wall. An hour later, I was still slumped on the couch when my phone rang, but I wasn't in the mood to answer. I glanced at the screen and saw it was my friend Brandon. I picked it up and began to vent, telling him everything that happened. "I'm so sorry, man," he said. "What do you think you're going to do?" "There's nothing else I can do. I did everything those authors told me to. I followed everything the books I read said. There's nothing I've left out." Brandon was quiet. Then he said, "Well, maybe you could try a different approach. I read a story a long time ago, and I don't even remember where I read it, so who knows if it's true, but the lesson is really important." "I know you're trying to help, man, but I'm not in the mood to hear about another one of your books. You need to hear this one." "Ugh," I groaned. "Just give me a second," Brandon said. "So, the story takes place around the year 2000. The internet was booming and Amazon was killing the e-commerce competition. In the beginning, Walmart's executives hadn't thought much of it. But then Amazon's growth started eating at their revenue. Walmart's executives panicked. They called emergency meetings. They hired people, fired people, and filled buildings with more and more engineers, pouring all the money they could into their website. Nothing helped. So they focused even harder on being more like Amazon. They copied Amazon's strategies, tried to replicate their technology, and spent even more money. But still, nothing changed." "Bro, what does this have to do with me?" "Damn it, just listen," Brandon said. "So, one day, a new Walmart executive walked into the office. She looked around and noticed what was going on. The next day, she hung a banner across the office. Soon after, Walmart's market share skyrocketed. The banner simply said, 'You can't out Amazon Amazon.'" Brandon paused to let the story sink in. "Don't you get it?" he said. "You're Walmart." "What?" "Ever since you started looking for an agent, all you've done is copy other people's strategies. You've been pitching these agents as if you have the same strengths Tim Ferriss has, but you don't have the platform he has. You don't have the credibility he has. Your circumstances are completely different. You can't out-Ferriss Tim Ferriss." "Shit. He's right." Ever since I had been on my dorm room bed, I'd been obsessed with studying the paths of successful people. And while that's a good approach to learning, I couldn't solve every problem that way. I couldn't copy and paste other people's playbooks and expect it to work exactly the same for me. Their playbook worked for them because it was their playbook. It played to their strengths and their circumstances. Not once had I ever looked within myself and wondered about my strengths or my circumstances. What did it mean to out-Alex someone? While there's a time for studying what worked for other people, there are moments when you have to go all in on what makes you unique. And in order to do that, you have to know what makes you, you. Late that night, I couldn't sleep. I kept tossing under the covers, thinking about the story Brandon had told me. You can't out Amazon Amazon. The hours crept by. Nothing I did would quiet my mind. At about 3 in the morning, I climbed out of bed and walked to the corner of the room. I found the crumpled list of agents. I opened it and stared at the name at the top of the list. The agent in San Francisco. Screw it. I have nothing to lose. I grabbed my laptop and began writing her an email. But instead of saying the same thing I did to all the other agents, I just wrote about why I believed in the mission. I told her I was sick of the publishing industry and tired of playing games. I told her my story and then, for paragraph after paragraph, told her how I thought the two of us could change the world together. In the subject line, I wrote my 3 a.m. stream of consciousness. And as I reread the email, it felt like a teenage love letter, but I sent it anyway. I didn't expect a response. A day later, she replied, "Call me." I did, and she offered to be my agent on the spot. Chapter 16. No one ever asks. I pulled my duffel bag out of Mickey's closet and began packing. Wait, Mickey said. Where are you going? You can't go now. My flight home leaves in a few hours, I said. That's impossible. You have to change your flight. You can't miss Agrapalooza. Agrapalooza was Mickey's summer camp-themed costume party, which she was hosting at a friend's house in New Jersey. I'd love to, I said, but I don't think I should. After talking with my literary agent, I learned I had to completely rewrite my book proposal, and I wanted to finish it as quickly as possible. Little bro, you're changing your flight. End of discussion. But, Mickey. The following morning, I woke up on a couch at Mickey's friend's house, the New Jersey sun flooding through the windows. On the other side of the room, I saw Mickey talking to a man with a shaved head and a navy blue Zappos t-shirt. I picked the crust out of my eyes. It was like seeing Santa on Christmas morning. Standing 10 feet away from me, talking to Mickey, was the CEO of Zappos, Tony Hsieh. Deep breaths. Elliot had taught me you can either be someone's friend or a fan, but never both. So I tried to play it cool, thinking of ways to introduce myself. But I thought so much about what to say, I ended up saying nothing at all. I headed out through the sliding glass doors. The backyard was so big, a golf cart was parked to help people get around. As the party began, I stumbled my way through the three-legged race, then got second place in the egg toss. Before the next game, a few of us headed to the patio to grab some food. We were standing under a large orange umbrella when Tony Hsieh passed by. No one, especially myself, could help but sneak a glance. A few minutes later, Tony approached us again, but this time he stopped and joined us. He had a clipboard in one hand, a purple marker in the other. "What's your wish?" Tony said to the guy on my right. "Huh?" the guy said. Tony flashed his clipboard. "Wishes list" was written across the top. "You didn't hear?" Tony said. "Today I'm a magical fairy." He said it with such a straight face, it took a few moments to realize that this was just his sense of humor. Mickey later explained to me that Tony's face always looks like it's made of stone. His eyes of glass. He has a permanent, uncrackable poker face. "I want to teleport," the guy said. "Okay," Tony replied. "You'll be teleporting 85% of the way there." He pointed to the bottom of the clipboard. 15% commission will be taken on all wishes upon granting. "I'm less a magical fairy," Tony said, "and more a wish broker. Hey, a fairy's gotta make a living too." He turned and asked for my wish. I tried to think of something funny, hoping it would get him to like me, though a part of me wanted to tell him the first thing that came to mind. But I can't ask for that. He'll think I'm obnoxious. And what if Mickey gets mad? And thankfully, I realized what was going on. This was the flinch disguised as logic. I gave myself a mental slap and forced myself to spit it out. "I want to be CEO of Zappos for a day." Tony didn't respond. He didn't write my wish on his clipboard. He just stared at me. You know, I said, trying to explain myself. Like, I follow you around, see what a day in your life is like. Oh, you want to shadow me? I nodded. Tony took a moment to think. Okay. Sure, he said. When do you want to do it? Well, it's my 20th birthday in a couple weeks. So how about then? Cool. And since it's your birthday, we can do it for 2 days. It was a few hours after dinner, and the costume dance party was about to start. I was passing through the kitchen when I saw Tony, dressed as a teddy bear, deep in conversation with Asif Manvi, the senior Middle East correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, who is dressed as a hillbilly. I overheard Asif saying he was writing a book. He was asking Tony for marketing advice, and I stepped over to join them. Well, there's a lot of tactics you can use, Tony told him, but I can't tell you which ones would be most effective until I know what your motivations are for writing the book. What are your end goals? Asif's forehead furrowed. Most people never take the time to ask themselves why they're doing what they're doing, Tony said. And even when they do, most people just lie to themselves. Like for delivering happiness, I'm aware that deep down there was definitely some vanity and ego at play. It's nice to go to your mom and dad and tell them your book is number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So that was one motivation. Another was, I couldn't tell if I was more shocked or confused hearing that. I'd always thought vanity and ego were bad. I never would have used them to describe myself, but Tony did, without any shame or hesitation. His face was as emotionless as ever. Ego isn't particularly healthy, Tony continued, but what's worse is having and lying to yourself that you don't. Before you start thinking about marketing tactics, become self-aware of what's motivating you below the surface. Don't judge the motivations as good or bad, just ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing. Choosing the right tactics become easy once you know your end goal. Tony explained that just because there was some vanity in wanting to write a bestseller, it didn't diminish his other motivations of wanting to inspire young entrepreneurs or teaching people how to create a strong company culture. Those desires coexisted. As the conversation went on and more people gathered in the kitchen to listen, I took a moment to mentally step back to appreciate what was going on. Here I was, dressed as Rango the Chameleon Cowboy, with a tail sticking out of me and a cowboy hat on my head, listening to a teddy bear tell a hillbilly how to launch a book. The first 3 months after your launch are the most important, Tony said. Because one of my end goals was for my book to become a bestseller, I spoke everywhere I could during those months. Business conferences, college classes, wherever. I bought an RV, wrapped it with an image of the book cover, and spent 3 months living on the road. Those 3 months were some of the most exhausting of my life, he said. I was speaking all day and traveling all night. I was doing everything I could to spread the seeds, but even then, I couldn't be everywhere at once. So I sent boxes of books to events and conferences, hoping the message would reach people. Honestly, I have no idea if those books were ever read. I didn't even know if that made a difference. I have to tell him. But the spirit of Elliot was hanging over my shoulder. Don't be an idiot. If you tell him, he'll always see you as a fan. In that moment, though, I knew I had to be myself. Tony, I said. During my freshman year of college, I was a volunteer at one of those business conferences you had sent boxes of books to. I had never heard your name before, and I didn't even know what Zappos was, but the event coordinators were handing out your book, so I took one home. A few months later, when I was going through one of the toughest times in my life, I picked up your book and couldn't put it down. I read the whole thing that weekend. Reading about how you chased your dream, well, it made me feel like mine was possible. If you didn't send those books to that business conference, I wouldn't be doing what I do today. Tony, your book changed my life. Everyone in the kitchen froze. Tony was looking at me, silently, with the softening of his face and the welling of his eyes. told me more than any words could have said. 2 weeks later, downtown Las Vegas. I ripped open a UPS box and pulled out a navy blue Zappos shirt. To anyone else, it was just a piece of fabric. But to me, it was Superman's cape. I had just woken up in a unit in Tony's apartment building, where he had arranged for me to stay. I slid the shirt over my head, grabbed my backpack, and headed downstairs where a Zappos company car was waiting. The car curved along the road, and 10 minutes later, we pulled up to Zappos headquarters. As I stepped through the doors, I saw a popcorn machine on the reception desk, a Dance Dance Revolution arcade game by the couch, and hundreds of cut-off neckties stapled to the walls. An assistant escorted me down a hallway to the work area where the desks were decorated even more wildly than the lobby. One aisle was covered in an avalanche of birthday streamers, another with flashing Christmas lights, a third had a 10-foot inflatable pirate. Sitting at a cluttered desk in a rainforest-themed section was Tony. He was hunched in front of his laptop. When he saw me, he motioned for me to grab a chair. I said good morning. Tony's assistant leaned over to me and whispered, "You're about 5 hours late. He's been up since 4. Tony shut his laptop, stood up, and motioned for me to follow. We moved down the carpeted hallway to our first meeting. I trailed a few feet behind the methodical steps of his black leather shoes. I could feel how timid my steps were. Despite how nice Tony had been, I still felt I didn't deserve to be there. A part of me was scared that if I even did the smallest thing wrong, he'd send me home. We got to the conference room. I spotted a chair in the back and moved toward it. Tony saw me, shooed away the seat, and pointed to the spot next to him. When we went to another conference room for our next meeting, Tony motioned for me to sit next to him again. He did it again in the meeting after that. By our fourth meeting in the afternoon, I sat next to him without him having to point. After our lunch meeting with a corporate distributor, Tony exited into the hallway with me behind him. He turned his head back over his shoulder and asked, "What'd you think?" I stumbled out an answer. He didn't respond. He just listened, nodding. After our next meeting, again he cranked his neck back and asked, "What'd you think?" Tony asked for my opinion again, then again. The light outside the windows began to darken. The office emptied. As we walked out of the final meeting, Tony again asked me what I thought. But he didn't have to crank his head back this time. I was no longer behind him. I was walking beside him. The next morning, I threw on another Zappos t-shirt and went downstairs where Tony's driver was waiting for me. We headed across town to a 2,000-person auditorium where Tony was preparing for a company-wide meeting. He'd already been there for 2 hours. I arrived at the auditorium and stayed backstage all morning watching Tony rehearse. The presentation was a cross between a corporate keynote speech and a high school pep rally. Hours later, the lights dimmed and the curtains opened. Tony's dad and I sat together in the front row watching it all unfold. As the day came to an end, I was heading out of the auditorium when a Zappos employee stopped me by the door. He said he saw me shadowing Tony the prior afternoon. The guy told me that he'd worked at Zappos for a few years and one of his biggest dreams was to shadow Tony. He asked how I got so lucky. The look in his eyes wasn't new. I had noticed a few other Zappos employees looking at me the same way the day before, as though they wanted to be in the position I was in. Later that evening, I went over to Tony and said goodbye, thanking him for the past 2 days. "And I know this might sound weird," I said, "but why don't you let your employees shadow you?" Tony looked at me blankly and said, "I'd be happy to, but no one ever asks." Chapter 17. It's All Gray. 2 weeks later, the storage closet. I kept pacing, glancing at my phone on the desk. I knew I should call, but I couldn't. A memory kept flashing in my mind. "You gonna drop out?" Elliot had asked.
"What?
You heard what I said." He was the last person I wanted to talk to about this. But I also felt he was the only person I could talk to. I reached for my phone. "Hey guy, what's going on?"
"Elliot, I need your help."
I told him my literary agent said the ideal time to pitch publishers was next month, which meant I needed to finish rewriting my book proposal by then. But my junior year of college began in a week.
"So what's the problem?" Elliot asked.
"I know if I go back to USC this semester, homework and tests will pile up and I won't finish rewriting the proposal in time. So I guess I know what I need to do, but the last thing I want to do is look my parents in the eye and tell them I'm dropping out of school."
"Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. You are not dropping out of school."
"Wait, what? No one smart actually drops out of school. It's a myth. Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg didn't drop out the way you think they did. Do some research. You'll see what I'm talking about." When we got off the phone, I ran my finger across my shelf and plucked out a book I hadn't opened yet. The Facebook Effect, the authorized account of the company's early days. And there it was, on page 52. The summer before Mark Zuckerberg's junior year of college, he was in Palo Alto working on a couple side projects, one of which was a website called The Facebook. It had launched 7 months earlier. Later that summer, Zuckerberg pulled his mentor Sean Parker aside and asked for advice.
"Do you think this thing is really going to last?" Zuckerberg asked. "Is it a fad? Is it going to go away?"
Even when Facebook had 200,000 users, Zuckerberg had doubts about its future. I sensed I was onto something, but I wasn't sure what. I took up my laptop to dig deeper. After spending hours on YouTube watching interviews of Zuckerberg, I finally found one that shed more light. Weeks before his junior year, Zuckerberg met with venture capitalist Peter Thiel to raise money for Facebook. When Thiel asked if he was going to drop out of school, Zuckerberg said no. He planned to head back for his junior year. Right before classes began, Zuckerberg's co-founder and classmate Dustin Moskovitz figured out a more practical approach. "You know," Moskovitz said, "we're getting to have a lot of users, we have an increasing number of servers, we have no operations guy, this is really hard. I don't think we can do this and take a full course load. Why don't we take one term off and just try to get it under control so that way we can go back for spring semester?" So that's what Elliot was talking about. Ever since I had watched The Social Network, I'd thought of Zuckerberg as a rebel who dropped out of school, threw his middle finger to the sky, and never looked back. The film never showed Zuckerberg doubting Facebook's future. It never showed him cautiously debating taking one semester off. For years, I had seen headlines that read, "Dropout Mark Zuckerberg," and naturally assumed his decision to leave college was clear-cut. Headlines and movies make things seem black and white. But now I was realizing the truth is never black and white. It's gray. It's all gray. If you want the whole story, you have to dig deeper. You can't rely on headlines or tweets. Gray doesn't fit in 140 characters. I grabbed a book on Bill Gates, and on page 93, there it was again. Gates didn't impulsively drop out of college either. He took just one semester off during junior year to work full-time on Microsoft. And when momentum for the company didn't fully pick up, Gates went back to college. Again, no one talks about that. It wasn't until the following year that Gates took another semester off, and then another as Microsoft grew. Maybe the hardest part about taking a risk isn't whether to take it, it's when to take it. It's never clear how much momentum is enough to justify leaving school. It's never clear when it's the right time to quit your job. Big decisions are rarely clear when you're making them. They're only clear looking back. The best you can do is take one careful step at a time.
Although the idea of dropping out of USC altogether didn't sit well with me, staying enrolled and taking one semester off sounded perfect. I drove to campus, spoke to my academic advisor, and she handed me a bright green form that said, USC leave of absence, which gave me a 7-year window to return to classes at any point. I ran off to tell my parents the good news. A semester off? My mom yelled. Are you out of your mind? She was slicing tomatoes in the kitchen. Mom, it's not as big of a deal as you think. No, it's a bigger deal than you think. I know you. I've known you longer than you've known you. I know that once you walk away from school, you'll never go back. Mom, it's just a... No! My son is not going to be a college dropout. It doesn't say dropout, I said, waving the green form in the air. It says leave of absence. She sliced harder into the tomato. Mom, you just have to trust me. Elliot told me. I knew it! I knew Elliot was behind this! This has nothing to do with Elliot. I love college, but then why can't you stay? Because I need to get this publishing deal. The moment I get one, I'll get to Bill Gates. And once he's in, the mission will hit its tipping point and everyone else I want to interview will be in. I have to make this happen. But what if you can't make this happen? Or worse, what if you don't realize you can't make it happen? What if you try to get the book deal and you don't get it? So you try again and again, and it's not until years later that you finally call it quits and decide to go back to school, and then they won't let you back in. I explained to her the 7-year window. My mom stared at me with gritted teeth, then stormed off. I went to my bedroom and slammed the door. But as soon as I collapsed on the bed, a voice within me wondered, what if mom is right? Normally, when my mom and I argued like this, I would call my grandma. But now, that was the last thing I could do. My insides knotted as I thought about it. Chunaman, I had sworn on my grandma's life I wouldn't drop out. How could I break that promise? But staying true to that promise wouldn't be staying true to myself. When I had said those words, I didn't know where my life would lead. The advice I got at Summit from Dan Babcock came to mind. Success is a result of prioritizing your desires. But how could I prioritize this? Family, of course, comes first. But at what point do I stop living for others and start living for myself? The tension pulled at me. I called Elliot that night, filled with fear and confusion, but his voice couldn't have been more matter-of-fact. I went through that same stuff with my parents, he said. But then I realized, why the hell is school supposed to be one size fits all? There's a line from a Kanye song I heard years ago. Told him I finished school and I started my own business. They say, oh, you graduated? No, I decided I was finished. You did school, Elliot said. Now it's time for you to do you. It's time for you to finish. Every day for the next week, I sat in the living room with my mom and dad, trying to make them comfortable with my decision. I was now down to the final day to submit the leave of absence form. There were 3 hours until the deadline. I had signed the form and was in my room, getting ready to drive to campus to hand it in. The more I looked at the green form on my bed, the more I felt fear pulsing through my veins. As much as Elliot's guidance had helped, 20 minutes on the phone with him was nothing compared to 20 years of living with my mom. A part of me felt she might be right. Maybe 10 years from now, I would end up delusional, without a publishing deal, and without a college degree. Although I knew I had a 7-year window, and Elliot had told me not to worry, I still felt I might be making the biggest mistake of my life. As I tied my shoes, the doorbell rang. I slipped the green form in my pocket, grabbed my car keys, and headed for the door. I twisted the knob and pulled it open. It was my grandma. She was standing on the steps, trembling.
tears streaming down her face.
Step 4. Trudge through the mud.
Chapter 18. Hallelujah. I locked myself in the storage closet and rewrote the book proposal as fast as I could. I didn't talk to my friends. I didn't see my family. I slept just 3 or 4 hours a night. When I would close my eyes, one image kept coming back to me as if it had been chiseled into the insides of my eyelids. My grandma, tears streaming down her face. Qi Lu had told me he had slept only a couple hours a night while creating Yahoo Shopping, and I had wondered how it was possible. Now I knew. My agent had told me rewriting the proposal would take 30 days. I finished in 8. When your back is against the wall, you learn what you're capable of. I emailed her the 140-page document, prayed she could work her magic. And then, just 11 days after I had turned in the leave of absence form, I got the publishing deal. I immediately shared the news with my parents, even my dad, who celebrated every possible occasion, couldn't crack more than a smile. I could tell he was still shaken by my leaving school. I needed to talk to someone who I knew would be as excited as I was. I called Elliot. No, you didn't. No way. You're lying. It really happened. Holy shit. You did it. It worked. Bro, you're a superstar. I had never heard Elliot talk to me like that before. This is nuts, he went on. So, what are you going to do next? Now it's time for me to get my interview with Bill Gates. That's insane. How much time do you think you'll get with him? Are you going to do it at his office? Are you going to do it at his home? Is it just going to be you two one-on-one? Or will you be in a room with a dozen PR guys? Dude, I still haven't told his chief of staff the news. Stop. That email has to be perfect. We spent the next hour on the phone drafting it. I didn't write a direct ask because I assumed it was abundantly clear why I was reaching out. Before hitting send, I thought about how just 2 years earlier, I was on my dorm room bed fantasizing what it would be like to learn from Bill Gates. It was finally coming together. A day later, the chief of staff's reply popped up on my screen. I felt as though a gospel choir had stepped into the storage closet singing, Hallelujah! I wanted to call Elliot so we could read the response together, but I couldn't wait. I clicked it open. Well, that's fantastic news. Congratulations. I hit the down arrow, searching for the rest of the message. But that was it. Clearly, my email strategy didn't work, but I wasn't deterred. I emailed the chief of staff again. A week passed. No response. I told myself he must not have seen my message, so I sent a third email. Another week passed. There was still no answer. I began to come to terms with what his silence meant. The answer was no. And not only was no, but now the chief of staff wasn't talking to me. The choir stopped singing, gathered their things, and slipped out the door. I had guaranteed my publisher I'd get Bill Gates. Now I had no Bill Gates. What would my agent say? How would I explain this to my parents after I had sworn Gates would be a done deal if I took a leave of absence? I had disappointed my family, let down my agent, and lied to my publisher. The asshole trifecta. I frantically thought through my options in the storage closet. All right. If I can't get Bill Gates, I'll get Bill Clinton. Elliot has an in with him, and if I can't get Clinton, I'll get Warren Buffett. Dan can't help me with that. Plus, Buffett is best friends with Gates, so if I interview Buffett, he can get me to Gates. I don't even need the chief of staff. While I had sent interview requests to most of these people before, I didn't know what I was doing back then.
Now I felt a bit more experienced, and the more I dreamed up next steps, the better I felt. My friend from Summit works for Oprah, so I have an in there. And another friend from Summit worked for Zuckerberg. Maybe she can get me to him. And Elliot is friends with Lady Gaga's manager, so I'm definitely golden there. I downloaded photos of Lady Gaga, Warren Buffett, Bill Clinton, Oprah Winfrey, and Mark Zuckerberg, pasted them on a single page, and printed a dozen copies. I taped the pictures by my desk, on the walls, above my bed, and on my car's dashboard. Only in hindsight can I see the change that was overtaking me. I had left school and felt completely on my own, and I had sold everyone around me on a dream that was now falling apart. I was so terrified of being seen as a liar, so ashamed of being seen as a failure, that I became desperate to do whatever it took to save face. Ironically, that desperation fueled me to lie and fail even more. "The momentum couldn't be stronger," I told Elliot over the phone. "I'm sure Bill Gates' chief of staff will get back to me any day now. Anyway, now that things are going so well, it's the perfect time to get the rest of the interviews. Could you introduce me to Lady Gaga's manager? And didn't you say you knew Buffett's grandson and Clinton's assistant?" I felt horrible about misleading Elliot, but an hour later I felt a lot better when I saw an introduction to Lady Gaga's manager in my inbox. I asked for the interview, the manager replied back, and the answer was no. Elliot contacted Bill Clinton's office, another no. Elliot introduced me to Warren Buffett's grandson, dead end. A friend from Summit took me to a party where I met Buffett's son, no help. Another friend from Summit introduced me to one of Buffett's business partners. Again, the answer was no. A third friend from Summit introduced me to Oprah's PR team. When I explained the mission to them, they loved it and told me to write a letter addressed to Oprah. They passed it along to the first level in her PR chain, and it was approved. The second and the third level approved it too. Finally, it made it to Oprah's desk, and her answer was no. My fear of failure had its hands around my neck, cutting off circulation to my brain. The only thing keeping me from suffocating was knowing I still had one ace up my sleeve. It was time to call Dan. Dan seemed like the obvious route for me to get to Warren Buffett. After the breakfast at Summit, where Dan shared the avoidance list, we became friends and talked on the phone every week. But any time Buffett's name came up in conversation, Dan seemed to get uneasy. I figured he was extremely protective of his former boss, so I had decided going through Elliot to get to Buffett would be easier, but now Dan was my only hope. Instead of being transparent about what I wanted, I called Dan and said, "I miss you, man. When are we hanging out?" He suggested I come to San Francisco for the weekend and stay with him on his boat. I jumped on the offer. A few nights later, I landed in San Francisco and my cab pulled up to a fog-shrouded marina where Dan docked the boat he lived on. Before I even put my bags down, Dan wrapped me in a giant bear hug. He threw my duffel bag inside and whisked me off to a lavish dinner on the San Francisco Bay, followed by live music at his favorite cafe. The next morning, we played frisbee at a sloping, grassy park. Over the 2 days, Dan took me around the city, treating me like family. Throughout our time together, I never brought up Buffett. I hoped the more Dan and I bonded, the likelier it would be that he'd agree to make the introduction. I felt like a salesman plotting an ask with a new client, except this was my friend, so I felt terrible. And now I was running out of time. As I woke up on my final day in San Francisco, I checked my watch. 2 hours until I had to leave for the airport. I headed out to the deck where Dan and his girlfriend were lounging, looking out at the Golden Gate Bridge, coffee mugs in their hands. After talking to them for a while, I glanced at my watch once more. 30 minutes until I had to leave. I still hadn't asked Dan for the introduction. "Hey, Dan, can you look this over?" I took out my laptop and passed it to him. Dan's eyes narrowed as he realized that on the screen was a letter I had drafted to Warren Buffett.